good. I thought the desserts were nice. We'll be starting here in just a moment. So last-minute technical glitch. One announcement out. Consideration for everybody. If you've got a cell phone, if you might turn that off or at least put it on vibrate if you must remain in touch. And if you got a laptop that you're switching on and off, maybe you could mute that so we don't hear the musical jingles. With that, I'll turn it over to the panel and we'll get things going.
All right, I guess we'll get started. We think that this is a pretty important topic, and I guess maybe some of you here do. It's fairly new, so we didn't expect to pack the house. Kind of glad this many people showed up, actually. A lot of people don't really understand what this is about, since it is fairly new. And we've been working on it for a little while. And we've seen out in the industry, a lot of people trying to do something like this and just sort of looking for a better word than flailing, but that's what comes to mind. It's sort of thrashing about, trying to understand what the bad guys are doing to them, as they watch their boxes get owned and various things happen after that. Most people working on this are involved somehow in the government, it appears. Many of them have been doing this for years. Obviously, the military has been involved in adversary characterization for a long time. They do want to understand their enemy, their tools, tactics, procedures. Lots of manuals written, lots of things going on there. Not all of it works in the cyber environment. So recently, I'm guessing the past 5 years, people have started thinking about it. There's a lot of talk about critical infrastructure and how to protect it. And they sit around and have big meetings and talk about what they would do to take down critical infrastructure and come up with these worst-case scenarios and whatnot. And I think the people that are actually doing more are probably some of the commerce folks, because money's involved. And that seems to get people a little more motivated to take care of the problem. There have been a few workshops. I've been involved in some. Others have probably been involved in a few others that aren't on here. The Department of Defense mainly has been doing insider threat type studies because that seems to be their main concern. Although I see them doing a lot of things that look like they're battling the external script kiddie, because at least initially, a lot of their commands, whatnot, as they came up on the internet, were under attack, if you will. A lot of times it was just people playing around. You see a gov or a mil site come up, looking for a powerful computer to do something on, looking for more bandwidth. Pretty easy to knock over that many years ago. Things are getting better. But not because they're thinking about the adversary characterization, just because they're finding out better ways to keep up with tactics. So these workshops, we got a lot of people together. I'm not sure we made a lot of progress. We came up with a lot of action items and whatnot, and there hasn't been any funding to continue this research. And so I had a workshop last year in August where I invited a pretty broad spectrum of people, some of these guys here, and brought people in from law enforcement, from government, from the intel community, psychologists, sociologists, all types, to try to come up with parameters and attributes and how we can narrow down and understand what drives these people, not just what tools they're going to use, the cyber presentation that we're going to see. We're going to see them take a box as a defender. We'd like to get ahead of that curve if we could. We wanted to have more follow-up on this. We haven't yet until now. And we've talked about more workshops to come. I didn't get a lot of support from my company. And as I said, there wasn't a lot of funding out there to continue. There is starting to be now. So I think we're going to start making more progress. As I said, the defenders pretty much came up with a lot of bad assumptions. And I'm not sure if they just think differently or people are just too easy to agree with their colleagues. And we're trying to change that as well. A lot of people will come up with an adversary model where they're really more than talking about the attacker themselves, individual or group. They're talking about the attack that they see or expect to see. So they come up with, you know, ways to decide if an adversary could do this. Mostly the high-level adversary across the spectrum. Usually start down a hacker and go up to foreign nation state. And there's lots of other things in between that you'll see on some other slides. They attribute things like resources and complexity, how hard it might be to put together, and detectability or stealth. How easy can they hide it? Because they believe these guys don't want to be caught. That kind of thing starts wars and stuff, so they don't want to do that. As I said, the defenders think differently. They put it together. It's sort of their baby. They think it's going to work. They've tested it the way they know how, pretty much the way they expect it to work, and it sort of works. Then someone perturbs it, and it doesn't work that way or doesn't respond in a way they'd like to. They're back to the drawing board. We have to show them that a lot. And I think if you're into even penetration testing or any other security analysis, you've probably seen that happen too. The developer is just way too close to it. I think Matt will be getting in more into the threat profile at the end of this, and he won't say anything about chasing the top 10 list. My personal opinion, there isn't always a reconnaissance phase, intel gathering phase for these things, which is what a lot of people expect. So the port scanning becomes important to a lot of people. I think that's something you can drop on the floor. You might put it in your back pocket and say, oh, okay, there's a new port coming up, something anomalous. But if they're trying the same old thing, most people shouldn't really worry about that a whole lot, of course, unless they're unprotected. We talked about know your enemy. I think a lot of you have probably heard and seen the honeypot, honey net stuff. I've not seen a lot come out of them about adversary characterization. Know your enemy does not necessarily mean going to an IRC and listening to the chat about what they did somewhere or looking at IDS logs. Some of those things will have input to it, but we need to go a lot farther beyond that. You know, it says here, understand the threat. So every environment is going to have a different threat. So that makes it hard because now it's custom. And people don't want to necessarily do that. You have to actually look at individual system to mission impacts. If you understand the mission of a fairly complex system, do you understand the impact of a single system being taken? You know, are there trust relationships? Are there dependencies that can be taken advantage of? A lot of people don't see all the connections there. And of course, policy is something that a lot of people talk about. Some people have. It's not always in line with as built. As designed versus as built doesn't always work in the real world. So they might have a nice policy, but it really doesn't have anything to do with their current environment. And if they do, it's hard to keep up. Again, back to the assumptions. It's easy to go ahead and think about the likely or obvious things and the impact, but the hard ones are really the unexpected ones, the ones that you sort of discount because they'll never do that. So you think. They'll never be able to break into the software, and suddenly there's a new vulnerability. Right after that, there's an exploit found. Bam, you know, you're the first one taken. And so everyone else has the advantage of that because now they can get fixed. Signatures will go out, and you can watch for it, and maybe you're protected, whereas if you're the first, you're not. And I think we'll see some slides on that there here shortly. As I said, the kinetic world doesn't always translate to the cyber world. And a lot of that comes out of the people in the military, you know, throwing metal against hard targets or even soft targets. And they sort of understand that. And then they, you know, get into these strategies, general versus general stuff, moving chess boards on, or chess pieces on a board. They're struggling to understand the cyber world. And part of that is because they don't understand the effect, the impact on their mission. And it's difficult, again, because it's new. And a lot of these guys have been around for, well, I shouldn't speak, for 20 years. It's hard for them to transition. And so they have to look at a lot of young guys and hope that they're right. You know, again, the assumption, a lot of times we think of an individual doing something. You know, we talk about the virus writer who lets go of this virus or, you know, turns into a worm or whatever. We don't know that there aren't groups involved behind it. You know, we talk about what resources they might have, what capabilities they might have. We're guessing. We're guessing because we're on the end, receiving end of it. We don't know what they're thinking. We don't know when the attack starts, when the attack stops. We see a little bit of it, just bits and pieces as it goes. Yeah, to say, given the same tool, if I gave the same tool to every one of you and gave you a goal to go do something with it, I wouldn't expect to see the same thing from everybody. We'd start to probably look into backgrounds and things if we saw groupings of people doing the same thing. I think it'd be pretty interesting. But in general, we see people do different things with the same tool. And that means they might modify it. They might, say, for example, Nmap, simple scanner of some sort, port scan. Some people are just going to go blasting right at it and just hit every IP they can. Some people are going to take their time, maybe throw a packet or two, wait. A lot of these things are attributes that they put to the high-end adversary. They tell them that they have plenty of time. Some of these people do this reconnaissance for years. So there's lots of different things there. I'll leave that one. Another thing we have to be aware of is what I call the win-win situation, where the adversary comes in and gets some information, perhaps, learns something that we didn't want them to necessarily, but we don't see an initial impact on the mission. Our web server's still up, our database still running, everything looks fine. He may have come in and planted some code. We don't know that until the attack starts. Then we know. Go ahead and change the slide. I'll move with that. So some of the things we do as we call red teams, some of you may have heard the term. Some people probably think it's different things. We've tried to change that a bit. It's not just a bunch of guys getting together, this side of the room is bad guys, this guy's good guys, you defend, you attack. I won't say we've made it a science or necessarily even an art, but we've tried to make it a little more credible and consistent by understanding the adversary we're portraying, using the tools, tactics, procedures that we expect to see in a given environment. Again, that's not always easy. And of course, the second bullet there, a lot of things we do, there's starting to be laws against it. So I don't really worry about it a whole lot right now, but we're probably going to have to worry about it eventually. When we do these things, we get the get-out-of-jail-free card. So we're usually okay. One of the things that we've talked about, and again, some of that came from the workshop, is what we call a Cyber Adversary Research Center. And I think it's probably going to be evolve into some sort of consortium because, again, a lot of it's volunteer effort. And there's not a lot of people out there that are willing to give us money yet. But by doing things like forensics, some of the obvious things, unfortunately it's after the fact, but you can learn some things. And I think Toby will talk about what he does to extract information about the attack and infer what the attacker can do with that. We need to get more detailed with the characterization. A lot of people initially went to these high-level models, and they run them through lots of different, some of you may see, these simulations run, a lot of math behind it, sounds real good, but I don't think there's enough detail in the model. So they're making, again, assumptions about the adversary that don't fly, so you get a false sense of security in the end. So we're going to attempt, through the years, to come up with parameters and attributes that we can actually model the adversary with, and potentially detect them. It's called cyber observables. as we see. Maybe the sensors don't exist now. Maybe it'll be a correlation of IDS and other sensors like that. But the main idea is to bring focus to the area, show how it's relevant, show how it works, and build a research community that can solve the problem and help the defenders. So we want to characterize, and the theoretical part is for the model folks, for the people who aren't necessarily hands-on, but need an adversary to input into their modeling and simulation, or policy, or whatever. And in practice, we want to be able to find them. We want to be able to continue because the information changes, the tools they use. A lot of the tactics may be the same. That may be some of the kind of thing that you can use. Back to the Sun Tzu stuff, Art of War. If we see an adversary doing something, you may be able to infer something behind it. You may be able to infer intent eventually. We got a lot of work to do before we get that far. And so what we've done is conceptualize the idea of, I'm not sure who termed it, maybe it was you, the hacker pie idea, is that everybody has a piece to bring to this. So we're trying to make a full pie. We're going backwards, so we don't have a pie to cut up. We're trying to make a pie. And we all bring something to, some different elements to the table, and we're trying to put it together. And hopefully we can reach our goal eventually. And with that, I think I'll go ahead and turn it over. I'll try not to scrunch the mic too much.
Can everybody hear me? That's good. I'm going to try to keep this a little shorter than Dave. My name is Toby Miller. I work for Computer Sciences Corporation. You can see my email address is up there. About this time last year, I started working on a project about rating your hacker, your attacker, your enemy, whatever you want to call it. And these next six slides will give you a brief overview of what I did, what I've done, and what I plan on doing. Point scoring. I've given a presentation similar to this at SANS. I've gotten a lot of feedback. A lot of people are like, why do you have points? And my simple answer is the easiest thing I could come up with. And I like the KISS philosophy. Keep it simple, stupid. Nothing complex, nothing that would require a degree in physics to figure it out. Why did I do it? A couple jobs I've worked at, I've seen analysts, IDS analysts, look at in-map scans, look at any kind of traffic whatsoever, and they knew nothing else about it. They just had no clue on what kind of threat it provided us, whether this person or this attack, was a big deal, was dangerous, so on and so forth. So I came up with a system, although the system, to be perfectly honest, it tends to move more toward a threat system more than a rating system. It kind of combines the two. And also the third reason is to help management with the decision-making process. Managers need to be aware of the threat of possibly, if you can't come up with the, a rating or a profile of your adversary, the guy who's attacking you or, is going to attack you or whatever. And that way they can make a better decision. Go ahead. I have some categories that I used. I did passive OS fingerprinting or fingerprinting. I got a lot of flack about that. I think the source operating system can tell a lot about the user who used it. I've had all kinds of arguments that go against that and for that, so I just decided to keep it. Intelligence gathering. Certain types of intelligence gathering are more advanced than other types of intelligence gathering, so I added that in as well. The attack. I thoroughly believe that certain attacks require more skills than others, and therefore they should be scored appropriately. The exploit, I think somebody who's using a zero day is probably a lot more advanced than somebody who's going to Packet Storm and downloading some code that's three years old. Backdoors and cover-ups, we're talking rootkits, we're talking anything like that. Certain type of rootkits are more advanced than others. If you come up with your own one that gets the job done and it's hard to find, then in my system you get more points. And finally you have others. Others would basically cover anything not covered in the first five categories. There's the total score as well, which I break it up into a couple of different categories as far as script kiddies, a basic user, a power user, a systems administrator, and an advanced hacker, attacker, whatever you want to call it. And finally, the past, present, and future. I published an article on incidents.org last year about this time, about rating your attacker. Since then, I have created a website, ratingthehacker.net. I'm currently on revision 2. I'm working on revision 3, although until I get some more input, I'm not going to really publish anything anytime soon. And that's really about it. So I'll pass the mic to Matt, or I'm sorry, Tom.
When we first started looking at this a year ago at the Dave's workshop in Virginia, some of the models I brought to the table were mainly based around what we call the vulnerability kind of food chain, the way in which the person at the top of the food chain discovers the vulnerability and how it disseminates into the public domain and the placing of the adversary on that food chain and using that placing to determine the kind of adversary that they might be. We mainly work around two types of classification. The first is around technique classification, whether it be the technique that they're using for port scanning. You know, are they being fairly covert about it? Randomly scanning, your network from their home IP address in the hope that they find, some five-year-old vulnerability. And also techniques like using kind of mass routers. Obviously, your kind of high-end adversary isn't likely to use a mass router because it's kind of obvious that it's going on. This kind of cross-reference with the tool classification models. The port scanning technique will have a direct relation, obviously, to the tool that they're using. Mass routing tools, you have a lower end adversary. If you have a customized tool, then you're probably going to have a higher end adversary. A recent example would be the DCOM exploit, HD Moore posted to Metasploit 3 or 4 days ago. There have been some exploits floating around that attempt to employ a mass routing technique on that exploit. From this, we can make two characterizations. Firstly, the guy that wrote the mass router, and secondly, the people using it. If the guy truly knew the nature of what he was exploiting, he would have realized that by trying to brute force the return address, he wasn't going to have much success because it's a one-hit wonder. The service crashes after the first time you get it wrong. Some exploits are more available than others. If someone attacks your system with an unknown exploit, then they're probably going to be more of an adversary. than someone that attacks your system with a five-year-old exploit. All exploits have their origins. Obviously, the vulnerability discovery web diagram comes into that. We'll look at that in a second. And the ease of use of the exploit. Does it have hard-coded offsets, return addresses in the code? You just run and it goes straight in there, or does the adversary have to find their own return addresses? Do they have to understand the nature of the vulnerability? What mitigating factors are involved in exploiting that vulnerability? Are there any prerequisites? Do you need access to a name server? If you're doing a man-in-the-middle attack, does the adversary have access to, the name servers of AOL.com to, DNS poison or whatever? The disclosure food chain. Obviously, all tools and exploits have a story. Most exploits are, kept private for 10 to 20 days. It obviously depends on, the ethic, the policy of whoever wrote it. It can be, months, even years until exploits, filter into the public domain, even if they're exploiting a three-year-old bug. What we try and do is characterize people based on where they are in the food chain. So, even if they've written an exploit which is 3 years old, that they're going to get additional points for doing that. Obviously, certain exploits are written by individuals, some are written by groups. In the case of an exploitation by a certain group, if it's a private exploit that it's, say, I don't know, if Tesso, had a zero-day Apache exploit, if we knew about it but we didn't have it and we knew that guy was using it, then he may very well be a Tesso member. Therefore, we can characterize him by, the likelihood is he's going to be friends with Tesso, even if he's, not a member of it himself. And therefore, we can characterize, his facility to gain further exploits. Just as in real combat, it is an advantage to know the weapons, an adversary has, whether it be nukes or, biochemical weapons. It's also of use to be able to determine the kind of exploits that an adversary may have to future protect your network. And the pyramid metric. I'll finally leave you with this. If you can read that, okay. Right at the top there, we've got the discovery of the vulnerability. And right below that, we have the discussion of that vulnerability within kind of closed groups, whether it be private lists such as ZeroDD, or whether it be the local 2600 or whatever. And then there are two paths that it can follow. It either goes down the black or the gray. Obviously, sometimes exploits get leaked. It could be traded in the underground. Or the exploit may be, pushed over to Microsoft, in which case, it gets fixed. And even though the exploit will eventually leak, by that time we'd hope that most people have patched. Pass over to Matt now.
Good afternoon. Mike Key, I want to speak as to why threat assessment is important to me and kind of the perspective that I bring to it. My name is Matt DeVoe. I'm the head of the Terrorism Research Center. In addition to looking at conventional terrorism issues, we also spend a lot of time looking at issues of cyber terrorism. So this topic in the workshop that Dave held was of interest to me from that perspective, in being able to look at adversary characterization from a cyber terrorism perspective, as well as some of the lower thresholds and even higher thresholds of threats, such as hackers and nation states on the other side of the spectrum. The key point, or the key thing that I encounter when trying to do risk management within organizations is that security or attacks are seen as merely a technical problem. It's packets coming across the network, and that is the complete foundation for what you're facing. My friend Jay Healy has a good quote that he's used many times, saying, your adversary is not a one or a zero. When I'm doing risk management, whether it be for a government institution, or for a critical infrastructure provider, or an e-commerce company, one of the key things that we need to know from a threat perspective in the risk management process is the capabilities and intent of the adversary. I don't need to know that there are packets flowing on a network. I need to know who's behind the packets. Need to be able to differentiate the adversary to do security planning and incident response. Obviously, if you know who's on the other side, it'll dictate what sort of response you provide. It's an essential piece from my perspective of risk management. It's the piece that's completely missing right now. I'll put up a slide in a few minutes that shows the risk management process. Threat characterization is a piece of that, yet you can turn nowhere really in the community and get information with regards to what threats you're facing, what capabilities they have. And without doing that, you're not really performing risk assessment. Either you have a lot of money, or you're protecting against inappropriate threats, or you're not protecting against anything at all. Next slide. When looking at issues of risk exposure, here are the variables that we look at. What threats / adversaries exist? And I'll show you a listing of the categories that we use. What tools or capabilities can they use? I don't want to have a complete download from Security Focus, but I want a characterization somewhat like Toby's done with regards to what are the different classifications of capabilities that I might face. And if I can start to vector those different threat agents with different threat capabilities, I can start to get a better understanding of what my security posture is going to be required. How attractive is the target? One thing that I always hate about certification, especially within the government, is it's checklist-based certification. All systems are treated equal. And all systems are not equal from the adversary's perspective. There are some systems that someone might not give a damn about. There are others that are important from the threat perspective or very attractive from the threat perspective. We need to include that component in your analysis. And you can't look at that piece as kind of a chicken and egg syndrome until you look at what threat and adversaries exist out there. Then you'll know what's their goal or intent or likelihood that they're going to attack a specific system. What level of access can be obtained? This is the piece that the industry has down, right? This is the assessment piece, vulnerability assessment component. We know how to do that. We know how to look at the systems and determine what vulnerabilities exist, with the exception, you know, obviously of zero-day exploits, things of that sort. But we know how to go through the assessment process and feed that into our risk management. What impact would the attack have? Also good for calculating risk exposure. If it is a low-impact system, even if there are adversaries out there with the capability and the intent to attack it, it might not justify as much security funding, as many security resources against it. So as part of the rating scheme, you need to look at that as well. And then, of course, the safeguards that can be deployed to minimize exposure. When I normally give the presentation on this topic, it's about 2 hours long, but one slide I use looks a lot like a sand timer. And it shows that despite who the adversary is, there are quite a few core vulnerabilities or core types of capabilities that they'll use to exploit a system regardless of the outcome. By looking at some of those common safeguards across all of the adversaries and all of the outcomes, you can go after some of the low-hanging fruit. I don't have a laser pointer, but you see the cyber threat assessment piece right in the middle. And the threat agent identity capabilities information being a feed into that. Right now, when we do complete kind of risk analysis, that cyber agent threat capabilities information is derived kind of on a case-by-case basis from expert opinion. If you're within the classified environment, there's more material that you can draw on to look at those issues, but for the most part, it's the unknown variable. That's the key issue or the key thing that brought me to look at collaborating with this group here. Next slide. Threat agents of interest, here's how we characterize them. There are a lot of variations. This list has been around for a while. I'd like to differentiate between unstructured and structured hackers. Also, the differentiation that I like to make is the unfunded terrorist group slash hacktivist versus the funded terrorist groups or the international type of terrorist organizations like an Al-Qaeda that exist out there that have more resources, able to acquire more capabilities than just a single issue group. Next slide. You'll see some overlap here, and this is just a listing of the techniques or capabilities that we look at when we go through the risk assessment process. And I'd like to be able to, for each of these different types of attacks, be able to classify an adversary's capabilities against the system. Next slide. And put it in the context of cyber terrorism for a minute, because that's why I was brought into the panel. Implications for cyber terrorism analysis. Right now, when we think of cyber terrorism, the debate is divided into two distinct communities. The one on the left that thinks that bin Laden lurks in every monitor and is able to shut down power on the East Coast tomorrow if he wanted to. And then the one on the right, which says the terrorists don't have any clue with regards to attacking critical infrastructures or engaging in cyber terrorism. The truth is somewhere in the middle, and we've been spending a lot of time trying to characterize or look at issues of cyber terrorism. And of course, if you fall into one of those categories, how much are you willing to bet that your answer is right? If they're lurking in every monitor, you're gonna be spending a lot of money. If you think that they have no capability, you possibly leave yourself open to exposure. Slide. Characterizing cyber terrorists. Historical analysis doesn't work. Right? How many people in the room think we've actually had an act of cyber terrorism? Not a single person. I would agree with you 100%. There's been no true act of cyber terrorism that's ever happened. We did a private interview with Alvin Toffler, the futurist, for a conference we did out in California about a year ago. And he had a quote that I thought was very pertinent to this whole discussion. He said, September 11th involved a failure of imagination. Failure to perceive the threat as it existed. Failure to actually think that they would hijack things like perceptions. They didn't just hijack a plane, they hijacked our perceptions of what a hijacking was. Right? Prior to September 11th, 700 plus hijackings take place for one of three reasons: to either flee a geographic region, to attract media attention to a particular cause, or to use the plane and its passengers as a bargaining chip for some sort of political exchange. Our perception of hijacking was based entirely on that. I don't want our perception of cyber terrorism to be based on the experience countering hackers or looking at cyber terrorism as defined by the media. We need to do a little bit more of the red teaming type of stuff that Dave spoke to and start to imagine the threat and doing the characterization of what we're actually seeing in the real environment, trying to determine who's behind it so we can start to scope in the problem. Next slide. What are some of the key issues from a cyber terrorism perspective? And we drew these from what we knew about real terrorists. So when we started to try and characterize cyber terrorists, we said, okay, well, what do we know about terrorists in general that might apply to cyber terrorism? The one thing that we wanted to distinguish was the nature of terrorism had changed. That was an important point for us because it increased the scope of the cyber terror community from our perspective. Of those groups that engaged in the 700 plus hijackings prior to September 11th, how many of them are going to engage in hijackings for those purposes today? How many of them want to be compared or have their cause that where they've always used calculated political violence be associated with groups like Al-Qaeda seeking weapons of mass destruction, weapons of mass casualty? In our opinion, there were groups out there above and beyond Al-Qaeda that were displaced by September 11th. And that increased the scope of cyber terrorism and that we expect to see groups differentiate themselves by engaging in cyber terror attacks so that they don't have to engage in the actual hijacking. Lessons learned by terrorist organizations. I've got a guy who'll give a complete day-long presentation on the lesson learned process as the terrorist organizations have experienced it over the past 30 years. They evaluate what's happened. They develop their own lessons learned from not only successful attacks, but from failed attacks. And in looking at cyber terrorism, the lessons that they're going to draw are going to be from what we see out there in the wild, and also, in our opinion, what we see as far as critical infrastructure dependencies from things like strikes. What sort of lesson do you derive from the presidential intervention required to end the port strike on the West Coast? That's a key infrastructure, key node. Natural disasters that impact critical infrastructures helps them start to map out what some of the cascading effects are and draw lessons on their own. The long-term planning cycle. This is a key one from our perspective. We tend to think in terms of very compressed time windows. And from a terrorist perspective, we're facing adversaries that'll think in expanded windows of time. They're willing to outwait us, and that's an important thing. 5 years in the planning and execution of the embassy attacks in Africa. So even if, though we know that cyber terror attacks are on the terrorist radar screen, we can't be expecting the fact that because some sheikh in London talked about cyber terror 6 months ago that we're going to see it today. We have to understand that they're going to go through their own planning and capability acquisition cycle, and it might take them 5 years, but they'll take the time required to go through that. Another interesting point, too, that targets once identified will continually be attacked until destroyed. We see that perspective for a lot of different targets, whether it's the IRA or Al-Qaeda or Islamic terrorists. You see that perspective, and that's important in doing characterization as well. Because you can start to plan for, once you've identified an adversary as a terrorist, similar types of attacks against that same target or targets within that same infrastructure. And then convergence. This is a key issue when we look at capabilities acquisition. A terrorist organization might not develop in-house the capabilities to engage in cyber attack, but they can converge with other organizations, with other groups, or recruit in other environments to develop those capabilities. And so I don't like dismissing the potential for cyber terrorism within a group like Al-Qaeda, because we don't think they have the capability, when we know for a fact that they've converged with drug cartels, that they're cooperating with other terrorist organizations, and where there's money to be made or money to be had, there's a lot of capabilities that other organizations can bring to the table. So we can't dismiss just based on the fact that we haven't seen a terrorist that's been trained to attack systems, although we have seen them with MIS degrees, we've seen them bookmarking hacker websites, we know that there's an interest in the topic. Next slide. Likely aspects of cyber terrorism, when we bring everything to the table, we still believe the most likely form of cyber terrorism we're going to see is in parallel with a physical or WMD attack. If it can be used to augment or enhance the impact of a conventional attack, that's going to be the most likely avenue. Impacting telecommunications after detonating a bomb, going after hospital systems after releasing some sort of chem bio device. There are lots of things that might be explored in order to augment the impact of the physical terrorism. Decrease confidence in critical infrastructures or engage in kind of psychological operations. We think that's an important one as well, although not as attractive. If you can go after economic infrastructures, if you can cause the public to panic, if you can be disruptive. And any folks here that live in the Washington, D.C. area? Got a handful. How disruptive were two guys with a Bushmaster rifle over a period of several weeks? They had an economic impact, had people changing their behavior, zigzagging from the mall to the car. We can be influenced easy by things that are outside our control or things that we don't understand or are fearful of, and cyber terrorism can be used in that manner. To cause physical damage and or loss of human life, this is the sexy form of cyber terrorism that you read about in novels or see in movies, and it's the most attractive from a terrorist perspective. If you can be in Pakistan and cause planes to crash, you've accomplished your objective, you've launched a spectacular attack, but you haven't had to expose yourself to getting caught. Fortunately, while it's the most attractive, it's also the least probable. Because if you actually go and look at some of those infrastructures that could have a public safety impact from a mass casualty perspective, there are a lot of control measures in place, a lot of humans still in the loop that would prevent anything really bad from happening. I always like to throw out the nation state as a sponsor, using as a tool of strategic influence. We're in a mindset right now, at least within the U.S. government, that any sort of attack on critical infrastructures we see, it would be the blame Bin Laden game. And we need to remember that we live in a larger world, a larger context. What we think might be cyber terrorism might be an 18-year-old hacker, or it might be a nation state following unrestricted warfare doctrine and engaging in little strategic wars of influence in cyberspace. So I like to always throw that out too, is that we don't so narrowly define our scope that we're not looking at the other threats. That's all that I have. At this point, I've been asked to kind of moderate the discussion, open it up to questions. So I'd throw it to the audience if they have any questions for the panelists. If not, I've got a list of things that I can ask. Go ahead. Oops. Right over here in the white. They asked that we repeat the question. So the question was how the rating can be used for intrusion detection or situation awareness.
The rating the hacker model that it came up with came from me working as an intrusion detection analyst, came from me looking at packets 8 hours a day, trying to get an idea of what I'm dealing with 5 to 7 days a week, and being able to present what I'm dealing with, a measurement to management as to what we're as to what they're seeing and I'm seeing on the network every day. You know, if for instance, if I see a Unix RPC exploit, not the one that was just released last week, you know, from 3 years ago, and I see it attacking a Windows box, you know, if you go through the steps of my model, it's going to tell you pretty much that guy's probably a script kiddie. It's not going to be something that you need to lose sleep over. And you can sit there and tell your boss, okay, here's what I saw, here's what I came up with. I really don't think he's something to worry about. Maybe we should just keep eye on him. Whereas, you know, if your IDS caught something that's like a zero-day exploit and it just caught it because of the shell code and you've never seen it before, you've checked the mailing list, you've checked whatever, and you've come to realize it's a zero-day exploit, that's something that that is going to require a lot more attention and a lot more resources to recover from if it was successful. And that's where, you know, that's where that would come into play as far as that goes. Did I answer your question? Hopefully I answered your question. Pretty much. I mean, because you're taking various characteristics from the attack. You know, the source operating system, which can be tricked. I'm not gonna deny that. You're taking the type of attack. You're taking if you combine my exploit field along with Tom's tool field, you're taking the tools. You're taking if there's intelligence gathering, you're going to take that into account. If not, you know, so on and so forth. One of the things that I did leave out in the second one that I had in the first was I also had a part where you rated also the criticality of the server that was being attacked or the box that was being attacked. You know, if somebody's attacking a workstation, well, you know, it's critical, but it's not as critical as somebody attacking a credit card or server that stores your company's customers' credit cards, and you know, it's the key to your company's survival. So, you know, that was part of my original model as well. And I had taken it out briefly, and I had given this lecture over SANS, and I just haven't had a chance to update to Rev3, and I was going to throw that back in because I do think that is a critical part in coming up with an accurate rating system.
Other questions? There is one I saw over here. No. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Repeat the question, though.
Really.
He has
such a long question.
I wrote some of it down. Do you want to comment on capabilities of IDS and logs and how we can tell what the adversary is doing, particularly as it applies to someone who's smart enough to do the probing from one IP address and then launch the attack from another? How do you correlate the two to know that you're dealing with the same person?
It's going to be hard, and to be honest with you, you'll probably never be able to do it, but I think either Dave said it or Matt said it, this process is not going to be, it's not a science at this point. It's an art. And if you talk to many of the FBI profilers, they'll tell you that their profiling is, even now, after 30 years of work, is still an art, not an exact science. For anybody who lived in the D.C. area and heard all the so-called experts, the profilers who started the profiling business in the FBI, they had our sniper suspects last year as being white males, and they weren't. So, I mean, we may never be able to correlate and actually determine what's true. But the way, at least from my model, was set up, and the way I tried to set it up, was that wouldn't be your sole scoring. You wouldn't base your whole, judgment on that one source. It would cover the source. It might cover the operating system, the destination, and a whole bunch of other characteristics.
I think it was Dave who pointed out that, you know, we could give a bit of code to, you know, all of you guys, and you would all use it in a different way. And I think, you know, that's partially, you know, on that basis we can, you know, try and determine that an attack on the same host from two separate IP addresses could be the same person. Maybe they're trying to exploit a service using the same bit of code. Maybe they're, trying to use the same return address. Maybe they brute forced it from one IP address. They got the address and then tried the actual hack from, you know, another IP. Obviously, there's a question of time frame. You know, if you've got a really busy host that's, you know, getting hit all the time by attacks, then it becomes very difficult. But if you've got, you know, a quiet system that no one knows about, then, you know, doesn't get hit off, and then obviously two hits within the same half hour from different IP addresses, you know, may signify that, you know, the same person is trying to get you from two locations.
There's a behavioral component to that, I think, too, which is eventually, you know, we had tried to a greater extent to involve the folks that do the profiling a little bit, because the same person, if you see multiple attacks, will engage in some of the same behavior. Probably everyone's worked on incidents that were of that nature. They start developing an MO, or almost a kind of context to the attack that you can start working with over time to determine, yeah, this is the same person, or it's somebody very closely aligned, because we're seeing a lot of the same structure, seeing a lot of the same context to the attack. Had one over here, and then we'll go over here. Yes. Yeah, you said a lot is focused on the network intrusion detection, which is good, but for some adversaries we face, social engineering might be a more effective mechanism of obtaining the access that they're looking for, and what's being done to address that.
As far as the social engineering goes, in my model I do cover social engineering as far as intelligence gathering goes. The only problem with social engineering is how are you going to prove it? How are you going to prove your system was compromised by social engineering? It is extremely difficult to sit here and prove that your system was hacked because of a social engineering attack, just because, you know, the whole social engineering concept can cover many people. and it would be hard for you to be able to pinpoint the 10 people, for example, that were social engineered in order to hack your credit card server.
As far as the kind of social engineering and the kind of overall characterization goes, as Dave said to start with, this is a huge pie, and probably today, from the panel, you're probably seeing, less than 70% of that pie. In the original workshops, we had behavioral scientists from FBI involved. We had people who study, handwriting, who look at, the language on defacements, to see if we can determine, the age group of the adversary. If someone, hacked a site, maybe they asked, maybe they persuaded someone out of username and password, then I think with things like social engineering, you find that the people that do proper social engineering are one age group deviation higher than your average script kiddie, because they have to be socially developed enough in order to be able to understand, what to say to get what they want. It isn't just about IDS, logs. There are a lot of other bits of the pie that maybe we haven't represented wholly today here that, that go into the overall characterization.
I think you're on to a key point from the cyberterrorism perspective. About 18 months ago, to that list of capabilities that I put up there, we added one called insider placement that was based on experience that we were having where it was difficult or beyond the capability of the person that was trying to penetrate into the critical infrastructure from the outside. They didn't have the capability to engage in that attack because of the security posture, but because of failure to check out folks with access to with system administrator privileges, things of that sort. It was easier from a personnel perspective to actually get hired into the company as an administrator and start from the inside. And we've seen instances of that, and that's something that we always try to bring. And when we look at terrorists, for some infrastructures, we'll specifically point out, the likelihood of you seeing, a custom tool or a zero-day exploit against your infrastructure from a terrorist organization is very small. The likelihood of you seeing them trying to place someone inside the infrastructure and going from there is much larger. So that's definitely something that needs to be folded into the mix when dealing with that adversary.
Something else I want to comment on, the IDS thing. They've been trying to do correlation for years, understand how to put the attack together. I don't think they're there yet. And one of the things we do is when we start building an attack, start structuring it how it happened, trying to get all the pieces together, sometimes you'll see a big gap. And so we'll put a box in there. You can label it a miracle or whatever you want. But typically it is the social engineering aspect, got the information to allow the next step to occur. And another thing, as far as the non-cyber information, especially in Matt's world, I think, is some intel might give you heightened awareness, and someone threatens to do something, and it's a fairly credible threat. Everybody goes into a different condition, and they're ready for it, and they expect that person or that group to be attacking, so they sort of narrow their focus.
Got a question back here. Go ahead. The question was, we speak a lot in the context of individuals, but what do you do about characterizing groups, especially groups that might have a high turnover rate within their membership? Yeah, the social context of that, this is a difficult one, where the capabilities and intent behind the attack probably start to give you the most leverage, at least from the groups that I'm interested in. But I think I'd be curious, it was one of the questions I had for the panel too, is doing the adversary characterization, at what point do you tie in some of the analysis after incident or the honeypot type of analysis, the social context of the attack, What does someone do once they've been able to successfully attack the system? Do they enable it as an IRC server and all of their friends log in? There are things like that that you can correlate with kind of past attack honeypot analysis, I think, to start doing some of the group characterization.
As I said earlier, when you look at the tools guys are using, if they're private tools that have been written by the group, then obviously, you know, you may be able to detect that a group of individuals are, you know, attacking the system because they obviously share the same resource. You know, they share, you know, technology with each other, you know, new vulnerabilities, what have you. They, you know, some, you know, one member in the group may have, you know, found a SQL injection bug in your site and you decided to share with, you know, the other members of his group. The other members of his group are obviously, you know, likely to be friends of his, so they're going to be, you know, maybe similar kind of personalities, you know, at least, you know, maybe a similar age group at least.
Also, I just want to add, we have the concept of groups also, and so what we do is go up a level of abstraction. We can't stay at the tactical level because the tools change, but the tactics should be similar in a group, even with high turnover, because there may be mentoring involved. So you should be able to see eventually, if you gather enough information, that this group was, you know, the genesis of this person, and there's the teachings of this person that are shown in the tactics of these people. The other thing we look at, obviously, the commonality, and one of the common things we look for, as I think Matt mentioned as well, is the target itself. And what are they going after?
Yeah. The question is, what sort of work's been done to validate the models that you're looking at?
As far as my models go, I've correlated it with the honeypot data that I have, that I run, the honeypots that I run at home, and I presented the data to the SANS conference in the past. If you'd like to see some of the data, if you send me an email, I'll be more than happy to send you the data that I have, along with the model as well. And actually, for anybody who's interested, I mean, I have the model up right here, the original model, which has everything that I thought was involved, that should be involved, some of you guys have brought up as well. So, you know, if anybody wants to see the data that I used, send me an email and I'd be happy to send it to you. I haven't done that per se, but when we had the workshop last year,
that was one of the purposes of the workshop that we've had, to kind of to present our ideas and to have people, you know, play devil's advocate so we can improve our ideas. Obviously, you know, all the models we put together have come from, you know, studying and personal experience of, you know, of communities, you know, groups of people, you know, Toby's experience with, you know, analyzing IDS logs, so that there is, you know, a lot of, you know, real life background behind all of the models.
You're right. They don't have the baseline for that one-on-one type of debrief / interview process, and that'll probably impact over time how you're able to refine the model.
Also, the FBI. I had lunch with the FBI last year during the conference or during the workshop. And they're going through a process that's similar to this, except they're going out and asking people who are who have been convicted of computer crimes and trying to get a profile based off the answers that they get from the questionnaires that they've come up with.
Yeah, I was going to say the FBI did have plans at the workshop to do that. They had just started. I haven't seen any results yet. But the one thing you have to wonder about that in cyber crimes, especially since it's pretty new, you got a lot of early ones, you know, did you catch the dumb guys? you know, the typical problem with that. And then depending on who you're dealing with, when you do interviews in prison, you don't always get the truth out of these guys. I know that's a surprise, but it happens. So there also is information that DOD does a lot of that for their insider incidents. So they capture the data, and we've talked to them as well. They were at the workshop.
Other questions? Yes. The question is, does the rating system, is it impacted by what the perceived response to the activity would be or the attack would be?
But the,
Yes. That's the whole point. You don't want to send all your resources just because someone sent a packet to your network. And I see a lot of that happening. You know, they see a port scan, you know, oh, I'm getting DOSed, or what do I do? You know, they overreact. So the idea is to for them to understand, you know, what's coming at them, what protection they need, and how they need to respond. Yeah, if that happens every time, then you obviously need to adjust. But you know, the other problem with that is the high-end adversary may want to redirect attribution to the low-end. So, you know, and we've brought up also someone running a three-year-old exploit. If it's effective, the high-end may use it too. So, yeah, it's not absolute.
Another thing to remember is that the rating model that we presented here is only a small piece of the pie. If you incorporate that with what everybody else has brought to the table, and you threw and you put that all in one pie, you know, you get a better picture of what actually is going on versus just that little, my little piece of the pie.
Yeah, agreed.
I think we have to wrap it up.
Is that it?
45?
It is, okay. I'm being told we're out of time, so I guess there's one last follow-up if folks are interested. You have the email addresses. I guess you closed down already. Contact folks via email. Yeah, and for the press members, we'll be in the press room for the next 15 minutes as required by the speakers. For everybody else, we'll be at the social, drinking beer, and eating chicken wings. So we'll see you there. Thank you. Yeah.